You are listening to episode 19 of the Paper Player Podcast. I'm your host, Tony, and I'm joined by co-hosts Jeff, Pi, JB, and Josh. Guess what? He's not sore in bulk this week. What's going on,
fellas?
We're
all here. We're all here.
What was the last episode we had all three of us here, or all four of us here?
2 weeks ago.
No way. Oh,
maybe. Oh, it was longer than that.
No, it was 2 weeks ago. It was episode 17.
Yeah, you're right.
It was
you're right.
1 week.
I believe you.
I literally listen to it like every week, so I love hearing myself talk like once every 20 minutes compared to Tony talking all the time.
Oh, well, I'll continue to talk forever. Don't you ever stop me.
Oh,
I have the power to edit everything.
Stop that.
Okay.
Days. Right.
So we're going to add some hotness to all of our new episodes going forward. I got segments. I'm going to make Josh. I'm going to force you to make little tunes to introduce the segments. And we're starting off with JB's hot pickups.
I'm done with that.
Yeah, that's great. JB, what is the card that you want people to trade you the most right now?
Time Spiral. Get me Time Spirals. I need two more.
Wow. Wait, are you trying to build High Tide?
Yes. I got one recently from a friend who went to Gen Con and took one of the Verdant Catacomb like expedition. He took it in for me and they had Time Spirals for like $150 when they're normally like $190, mm-hmm. which I thought was crazy. Mm-hmm. So I had him like pick me that up and gave him a little cash on the side.
I need Jun Shocks, the Meat Hook Massacre, and a Bloodstained Mire.
I mean, I probably have like most of those.
That's what I'm looking for.
Just find me a Time Spiral.
Right.
casually find me an old card that nobody has.
I used to have one.
Everyone used to have one.
I like, right.
It used to be $30 once upon a time.
Right. It was in my Jace Fringe Prodigy EDH.
Nice. All right, Jeff. Another segment coming in hot. Boom, bang, bang, boom. Jeff, give me the bad card your bad card of the week.
So it's actually, I think I've talked about this a couple podcasts ago, but I think one that like everyone was hyped about and it turned out bad was Demi Lich. I was one of the people I was super hyped for. It does see like a one or two of in that new Jessica Phoenix deck, but the deck is still not top tier.
You remember when we talked about this? And I was telling
you pile in all
that mana and you got none left, and how the hell are you going to cast this thing?
It does work a little better in the Jessica one because they run the rebound Faithless Looting. So it allows for you to have a free spell on your next turn to make Demi Lich cheaper. So it's a little nicer, and that deck runs 4 Gutshot compared to like normal Phoenix where they weren't like red and blue. So it was harder. So you can get 2 free spells off in a turn, and only having to cast 2 spells and leave mana open does make Demi Lich a little better, but it's still only a 2 of, and your main goal is most of the time just to play Phoenixes.
Yep.
I think the only thing that Demi Lich was missing was if it had flying, it would be considerably good, but the fact
even
that it
doesn't
fly.
I remember
saying that too, as I was like, dude, it needs some kind of evasion, and then it'd be way better.
It's a 4/3 that has a lot of text on it, but the main thing is that the intended purpose is to cast it for free, and it does have the same CMC as like Vengevine, but Vengevine has haste.
And Vengevine comes back a lot easier.
Oh yeah, I mean it's a joke how easy to get that card back.
Vengevine's
price history is the funniest thing on the planet because it goes from like $3 to $60 to $3 to $50 to $3 to $80. That the card's the roller coaster of a price history.
When that card is good, it is awesome. But
it's
so hard. Like it only has its time in the spotlight for a very brief moment before they're like, oh, we got to do something because this is getting out of control.
Right.
People are dying on turn 2 and 3. And there's like no way to answer just because it's like, well, I wrathed and they come right back the next turn.
I'll admit Vengevine is one of my favorite cards.
Yeah, I played that in the deck.
You also love the graveyard.
Yeah,
I'm a graveyard guy.
Yeah, I played that and I top 8ed nationals with it. Not nationals, regionals. That got me a Gen Con invite with 4 Vengevine in my deck. In the top 8 was 7 other Jace the Mind Sculptor decks, and I was the only Vengevine deck that got through.
Nice.
Yeah, that was a fun tournament. I did an intentional draw with a friend of mine in round 2 because the entire field was just Jace decks. And I built that deck just to beat Jace decks. And then for the next 7 rounds, I played all Jace decks and smashed all their heads in. I was like, if I just take a draw here and every other player here is playing Jace and they're just brainstorming back and forth constantly.
You can just smash them. Yeah. That's funny.
Jace.
That's smart.
It was the only time I ever did that. But it's just because I was like, well, I only want to play this deck. And it was sweet.
The easiest way to do it.
Yep. Outside, big brain, big magic plays move by me. So the main topic I want to talk about with you guys today is going to be just about the overall card prices and the overall game of Magic. The formats that we like, there's a range of them, and the cost associated with each format varies greatly. And the intended way that, like, how we deal with Legacy, Modern, Standard, Historic, well, I know that's only online, but Pioneer, those are kind of set up as, like, to me, as tiers of how much you're willing to spend to get into a competitive format. So, Josh, what do you think that, like, the average cost of a Standard deck is?
Right now?
Sure. Or historically?
Historically, a Standard deck would be about, like, a good, like, tier one deck. Like, it was about a $400 investment.
Yep.
Is that true for right now? I think it'd be cheaper now.
Right now, it's, like under $100.
No.
Right.
Or around $100. Like, Standard cards are pretty cheap.
Nah, I mean, you're so if you were to look at like the, it's hard to judge prices because we're not playing it in paper anymore. So it's all through Arena. So you,
I guess that's true. The value like the, of like a wild card.
Right. So the mental calculation of like what a card actually costs. Like, for example, if I wanted to play 4 Goldspan Dragon, those cards are $50 each.
Fair.
So you need, that's $200 right there. And that's typically how a Standard deck is kind of constructed, where you have like the best mythic in the format, which is the Chase Mythic, and this one happens to be good in EDH. And then you have the rest of the cards, which any, they range from like $5 to $15, and then sometimes you see random spikes, well, like we talked about in a previous episode about Balkris turning from like Night Vale Spectre into like $10 bills.
Yeah.
I took a quick look at like MTG Top 8 or whatever, and it seems like everything's hovering around $400 on average.
I will admit, though, for Standard, like the mana base is like the cheapest part of it.
Yeah, that's what's crazy to me is like if you buy into something like Modern, suddenly as long as you pick up the mana base to play all the decks, you can almost play anything you want for like $300.
I've been saying that forever. As long as you have the lands, you can play whatever you want.
Standard's the complete opposite. The mana base is like $20 of your investment.
Yeah.
Like the new lands, the slow lands, are only like $3 or $4 right now. That's like extremely cheap. Normally like lands when they come out, especially a new cycle and something like this that probably see some eternal play, they're only like $3 or $4. Normally they would start at like 10 or come down a little.
I mean, we see that all the time, even when like major or really popular fetches come in, right? Like we've seen like Concentrate Gear, when those came, like when that came out, Windswept Heats were $8, and then when the shocks are available, they usually range from 8 to 15. Sometimes they can spike up to 20 when things like Uro exist, where you only play Breeding Pool, so everybody needs 4 Breeding Pool.
Yep, I was about to say green blue in the most recent release was like crazy expensive compared to all the other ones.
Yeah, and then every now and then we get like a new cycle of lands, like for example the Triumphs, which started off pretty small and they kind of just stayed at a solid $10. I know they rotated out. Every time I think of like historically, like fast lands, like Seachrome Coast, all those, that cycle of lands was like $3 to $5 when they were in Standard. And then obviously as time goes on, there's less and less of them. And now when you want to play a deck in Modern with 4 Blackleaf Cliffs, well, they're difficult to find and they're $50 or $60 a pop.
Right.
Because they never got a proper reprint.
Mm-hmm.
The reprint was in the stupid Zendikar Rising collector packs and or the box toppers, and those, I mean, they're cheap. Like the black blue one, the expedition version or whatever from Zendikar Rising is like $4.
Yeah, it's not much.
But black blue, I feel, doesn't see that much play in Modern right now.
No, it's whatever one is like you need, like the necessity. So, I mean, your cost is always changing, and obviously, that's just economics 101, supply and demand, right? If there's a red black deck that's really popular, such as one that would run Blackleaf Cliffs as a 4 of, those cards kind of sell out of the market, and then they just become increasingly more difficult to find. When cards like Razorverge Thicket exist, you'll like, and no deck plays it, well, you can get, there's a surplus of them and nobody wants them, and that's why you get those prices.
That's true.
Yeah.
I don't know. My other issue is when we talk about reprinting stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
We take a look at what kind of printing size they do when they do reprints, and it's always too small for what is needed. And I think that's calculated because they know they can get more money out of us later if they do it again later in something else.
Yeah.
So you look at something like Modern Horizons 2, where they said, yes, we're going to be reprinting some of the cards from Modern Horizons 1. Most of them they printed in very limited quantities of the like alternate, you know, the
old, border, old school retro, border.
Yeah. Yeah, with they were all foil too.
Yep.
So you know, Force of Vigor wasn't reprinted. It was reprinted at like a super limited premium spot that you're not going to get a whole lot of. So you saw Force of Vigor go from like $10 to $25, or Force of Negation go from $50 to $80. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the biggest issue comes in when we're talking from a modern perspective, is that we suddenly don't get the influx of cards that we need to satiate the amount of people coming into the format.
I think Wizards wants that, though, right?
Instability?
They want their cards to be desired. It's like artificial inflation almost.
Yeah, but sure. They're not selling singles, so like the desire and the cost of them being expensive is only benefiting like the second market. It's not really benefiting them.
Well, it does benefit them strictly due to if there's fetch lines and packs, people buy it.
Well, that way, yes, but I'm saying like a card becoming expensive, like he was saying about Force of Vigor, like how it didn't properly like get a reprint. I don't think Force of Vigor was making people buy Modern Horizon 2 packs. Like,
no.
Because it was so hard to get.
Right.
So like, I feel like that doesn't really benefit Wizards.
It benefits it to some point because from the secondary market, you want to have things on your store, your storefront, and you want people to come to your storefront, such as TCG Player, so they can buy a Force of Vigor and then whatever else they have they need, or any, you name it, Star City Games. So some amount of packs has to be opened and or like traded. We don't know what the amount is, and I don't know if they're reprinting Modern Horizons 2 packs, for example, but there's a finite amount of them. We don't know what the actual amount is, but there's just so many of these rares out there. But if packs don't get opened, like, let's say if they have a bad set. Like, I think of Ixalan, and that set wasn't very good. It wasn't really desirable. There's a lot of random rares in that set that are super EDH playable that are $50 to $60.
Which set?
Ixalan.
Oh, yeah. That's also because it had, like, a super hated, like, draft format.
Yep.
So like it wasn't open that much.
How much is that Gaia's Cradle card from Ixalan?
Rights or something? I think it's like 35, 45. It's getting up there.
What's search for Iskanta?
$4. That was the buy box promo.
Oh, that's right.
On top of that, it kind of lost favor in most decks.
Yeah. And
I don't even think it's that great in EDH.
I would play it if I had one.
Yeah, I would see play, but like it's not that valuable. Like,
no.
Gaia's Cradle for $40 is way more sought after.
Oh, that's the other problem, is when we're talking about, Tony brought up, you know, we don't know how many are getting printed, right? So if you think about it like this, they continuously talk to us about how they're doing print to demand. But the problem is they have a scheduled prints, or like a scheduled print for, you know, various sets that are coming out throughout
years
the year.
In advance, yeah.
Yep. And they can't really break that. So they can only print so much before they have to switch the printers over anyways, which means it's still going to be somewhat limited, even if everyone's buying it. I will say that the newest round of fetches knocked them down to a pretty reasonable price, and all the other ones are starting to kind of rubber band back down with like the reprint of the enemy fetches. But like I predicted, you know, maybe half a year prior to it coming out when they first announced it, I said, get your allied fetches because they're going to go up by like $10, and
they're all around 40 or 50. I think even Winsup Tease is up to like $30.
I'm driving up.
Yeah, like literally all of them went up by like $10-$15 or more.
They should just have a master set where they just reprint lands.
I mean, so when you talk about something like that, you think of the master sets on Magic, you know, Magic Online. Modo. Yeah, and they tended to do a lot better when it came to the amount of reprints and the things that people wanted. And then, I think that's the problem, is like with the digital format, they have a lot more leeway in doing something like that than they do in the physical format.
It's a lot easier to put some coding together to make a set than to like plan out a printing process.
It's not even just
structure, packaging.
Yeah, like shipping, all like, of that.
It's all that. You just literally just go, okay, well, this is there's an infinite amount of these, and until we take this off of our storefront, people can buy these. So as long as someone buys one, we will generate it.
Yeah, and not even in the print amount I'm talking about in this case. It's more so also that they don't need to really hype up the packs, I guess. They can just be like, pay $4, open up like 7 good cards for a bunch of different formats.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, you can literally get Black Lotus on Moto for like, I think it's like 2 ticks.
No, it's a little bit more than that.
There is a printing of it that is literally worth like 2 ticks. The one that's from actual Vintage Masters is like, I think like 40 or 50, maybe more, but there's a printing, a promo version of it you can get that's like 2 ticks.
Not anymore. It used to be.
The issue is what you're talking about is a thing that's super rare on there to begin with. So a lot of sites have it set at like 2 or 3 tickets for sale because that's the last time they sold one.
Okay.
So when they buy them, they update the pricing.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff like that. And the rental services have kind of crashed that economy on there. When we talk from MTGO standpoint, as far as Arena, there is no economy. And I would argue that Arena is incredibly predatory.
It's expensive.
Well, now it is. It was sold to us as they call it the freemium model, where you either spend money or you spend time. And now one is not true. One is.
It is, but like the amount of time you have to spend is like more than double of what you used to have to.
Yeah.
Like now, especially with how much products are coming out, like if you think about it, like right now, if you cash in all your wild cards to build a standard is going to change in 2 months when this next set, or a month and a half when this next set comes out. So you might have to like try to cash in wild cards for a completely different deck because yours might be invalid in like a month and a half. And that puts like a lot of strain on someone that can't afford, like listening to some of these people that like podcasts and stream Arena, they talk about like the amount of money that they have to spend per month. And like when a new set comes out, they're almost dropping like $700-$800 just to make sure they have enough wild cards to get everything.
Right. Yeah.
That's insane.
Dude, that's just the reality of it.
So my issue when you make that comparison is that the idea behind being a streamer is that you want to generate, obviously not everyone's going to do this, but you want to generate some kind of revenue for your hobby, right?
Yeah.
So if you don't have that kind of stuff, people don't want to watch you. So you need to be competitive and have that stuff immediately, which is why they do things like buy, you know, 3 pack sets of, you know, whatever the special deal is for $100 a piece or whatever, just so they can open up a bunch. And on top of that, they're playing a lot. So I feel like they're a little bit more, they get a little more leeway because they can build up those wild cards. And I'm sure they can take like a set off.
To an extent though, because for you to get packs, if you're like, let's say you're just playing a format, you're not drafting, because drafting and like playing events, I guess, is the only way to get packs. And most of the events only actually give you gold. You have a finite amount of packs you can open in a day without spending money, because you only get like 2 challenges a day that allow you to advance your battle pass that can give you packs. Mm-hmm. But if that's gone, you could play for 6 hours and not open a single pack.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not gaining anything besides increasing your ranking, because you don't get anything from going from like silver to gold and gold to platinum and so on and so forth, which I think that's something they could implement. Like when you actually like progress, like you get like a pack. But besides that, you can play for 8 hours and not open a single pack.
Ugh. Yeah. The only way that like really when I look at Arena, and I just use that as my ability to draft. Usually before I get burnt out on a set, I will go anywhere from 20 to 30 drafts. And usually the majority of those drafts are free rolled because I'm able to get 5+ wins on most drafts, just because the pool of competitors from a draft perspective is pretty low. And if you're just a slightly ahead of like the draft meta game base or the Arena player base, takes a while to catch up, so you can just go kind of infinite. Usually it's after the second time I've invested $20 in gems is when I stop playing the draft format, and that typically tends to be about 20 drafts.
Right.
So maybe every set I spend about $40, get 20 drafts worth, which is high value to me, plus all the packs. And usually at the end of my run, I'll have anywhere from 50 to 60 packs, bust them all open and see what deck I can concoct, and I'm still short wild cards every single time.
Right.
Honestly, the cheaper format to invest in on Magic Online is Historic. Your decks don't. What I'm saying is like if you can build a tier 1 deck in Historic, a lot of the time, like when a new set comes out, you're not needing to use a bunch of wild cards. It's like, all right, I need a 4 of this and this, and that's it. To get into Historic now is very expensive, but if you already, like, that's the format I play. Yeah. So a lot of the time, like changing a deck or like altering, like I have the sacrifice deck and I haven't had to add anything to that deck for like four sets and it's still a tier one deck.
Yeah, that's good. Every now and then a deck comes along like that, but I'll be honest with you, outside, like in physical Magic, you only get to play so many games, right? On Arena, I don't think I could play 100 games of Junsac or whatever version of Sac that you're playing.
Like eventually I have other decks. Like I have two. Yeah. I normally run either Jund Sacrifice or I have Arclight Phoenix because you have Faithless Looting on there.
Sure. But what I'm saying is because of my ability to play so many games, I remember in the last season, from standard standpoint, I was playing Mono Red. I got to Mythic and I was just like, dude, I don't ever want to play this deck again, but if I ever wanted to progress again, I only have this deck. I'm out. So I dropped down and was like, forget it. I'm out.
It is easy to get burnt out on. I always like invest the gems because I normally have them saved up to get the battle pass whenever it resets.
Yeah.
And I always end up getting to about level 50 or 60 before I'm just so over magic on online.
Yeah.
Like I get bored of historic and I'll switch to standard and then I'll get bored of that and then I'll draft. Like I finally drafted Midnight Moon the other day and I actually went 7-2 with red green werewolves. I know we were talking about that last time.
Yeah, dude, it's a.
I got lucky.
It's quite a feat.
I had the general or the commander one, the red green legendary guy, and
cross
like
cards.
I had just a bunch of like cards that like affected like day and night. Like I think I had three of the three drop red guy that pings every time it switches.
Yep.
And that card's really good.
Yeah, that card's awesome. The devil, the 2/3. Yeah, he's great. Yep.
My steel deck in League is really bad.
if you're not playing blue black, you're in trouble.
I've been playing against blue black. I'm playing white red right now.
Can't beat the blue black deck. If they have a good blue black deck, you can't beat it.
I'm getting dunked on.
We talked about kind of how expensive online is. And then so that's part of most Magic players' journey, especially new guys coming in. They use most people that probably play standard and paper are coming out of Arena and finding local stores that have it available to them. But if we start veering towards like Pioneer, we talked about, I know Josh, you said something about like, if you have your land base, you're good to go. But even the Pioneer land base, shocks are starting to go up too.
Again? Mm-hmm. Didn't they just put out a secret layer that had like all of them in it?
Doesn't matter. There was so like, it wasn't enough. It's not enough to affect the market.
Wow. Shocks have been reprinted so many times. Aren't they coming out and then unglued again too? Or unset 5 or whatever it is?
But sure. That's not till what, like 2023?
That's 2023?
I thought it was just next year.
Oh, no, it is next year, but it's summer. It's either summer or fall. So, I mean, that's still a good time away. And, like, it happens with most. Like, look at fetches. At, like, Scalding Tarn, when it got reprinted in Modern Horizons 2, dropped down to, like, $30, and now it's already back up to, like, 60.
Yeah.
It's, like, $25 right now.
I was supposed to say, no way. Yeah, it's super cheap.
Really?
Yeah, it's, like, $25.
Yeah.
Because it did go back up for a little bit, so like it must have dropped again. There must be another one of those fetches is up there. Misty or Verdant's probably up there.
They're all pretty cheap right now. They're like relatively cheap.
Yeah,
they're
if you want to buy your fetches, buy your enemies now.
$30 on the website or Facebook the other day. I was like, wow, these are cheap.
You did say they just announced another printing of Modern Horizons 2, though, didn't you?
Who, me?
I thought I heard you say earlier that they're...
No, I was talking about multiple waves, what they announce all the time. They say, oh yeah, we have multiple waves. Don't worry, print to demand. And it's like, no, it's not. It's never print to demand because there's too much demand.
I guess my question is now, is Modern the new... Well, it is. Is Modern the Legacy and then Legacy the new Vintage?
I like how you 100%. Preface it with, it is. Like, like you are correct.
Have you met Tony?
No, I was questioning if it was a question, and then I had to go back and be like, well, this is a question. Is Modern the new Legacy and Legacy the new Vintage? And the Vintage is obviously just some kind of crazy crunchy club that you need $20,000 a year to just play at the course at.
Get a car. I just want to play Magic. Just sell me your sell me your power.
Sure.
I don't need to drive. I just need to flex.
And you were questioning earlier why you have Tabernacle still.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. It's bad.
I agree.
Anyone want to trade? You got a mox that you want to trade me for that Tabernacle?
What do you want a mox for? That's even worse than a Tabernacle.
Tabernacle, you played an EDH.
I would rather
play a mox in EDH.
Yeah, I'd rather have the Tabernacle.
I really want to play some Canadian Highlander.
No, you got to get a Mishra's Workshop is what you got to get.
I missed the boat so bad on that. I was staring at them when they were like 900 and now they're like 2 grand.
a buddy of ours bought one specifically for his Golos EDH deck, and wah.
I mean, when did he buy it?
Like 2 months ago.
Oh God. Okay. I thought you meant he bought it like a year ago, and I'm like, dude, he made a solid investment in that case.
It's okay. He still has a Mishra's.
Mishra's Workshop and Time Twister are the ones you need to get.
Tell me if he wants to trade it. I'll trade for it. You got a big stack.
I'll hook you up with them.
Yeah.
So I definitely agree Modern's the new Legacy, because I mean, I haven't played expensive Legacy in a long time, but I remember playing Merfolk back when Merfolk was actually good, and the deck was only definitely sub $800. And I feel like Modern is definitely at that point now where it's hitting $800-$900 for a decent deck. And yeah. Legacy is, I don't even Burn even is $400-$500 or whatever. I remember when Burn used to be sub $100.
Yeah, that was the cheap deck to get in.
And now that's not even an option. Legacy is just, it's ridiculous. $1,500 gets you an okay deck.
You're also missing parts too, but yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think Modern's the new Legacy because anyone plays Pioneer or anything. I think Modern is just Modern, but it's gone up, you know.
We're not talking in the sense of the commitment or how often people play it. We're just from a price standpoint, Modern has come what Legacy used to be.
See, I still disagree with that because you look at Jund back in 2015 and that deck was $1,500.
It was also the most expensive deck at the time. Everything else was sub 1,000 easily.
But what is over $1,000 in Legacy right now or in Modern right now?
I think Modern is just a consequence. The Modern is just a consequence of inflation right now. I think you go to the grocery store now. I used to spend $60 at the grocery store last year. Now I go to the grocery store and I'm spending 90 plus.
Yeah. Well, all right. That could be it. But let me rephrase what I meant by Modern is the new Legacy and Legacy is the new Vintage. Modern is a format where you buy into. Let's pretend that we haven't played for 10 plus years. You started Magic last year. You have the ability to probably buy into one deck. And then you're kind of pigeonholed into that deck until you get funds for the next deck. And then that becomes increasingly more and more difficult because if you want to play different styles of decks, it just becomes more expensive. That was the truth with Legacy 10 years ago.
Modern 10 years ago. That's my problem, is you're talking this wasn't a thing back in 2015.
It was only, so Jund was the exception.
No. That. Because fetches were still a lot of money. Shocks were still a lot of money. And in order to play anything that was two colors or more, you were still spending $600-$700.
Right.
And you can do that right now and get a decent...
Because of the second wave of Ravnica, I thought.
Yeah, Ravnica dropped... Or shocks were really cheap for Modern.
You were picking up red-blue shocks for $6.
Yeah. Yeah, the price of shocks were low. Maybe I know fetch lines were a little bit up there, but we also had a Modern, whatever the Modern Masters came out with shocks or with fetches. The only things that were absurd, you guys are pinpointing Jund. And at that time, that deck was just straight up mythics, right? It's four time
base. And its mana base didn't run any basics, really. You were earning all shocks and all the fetches.
Yeah.
There's also GP Richmond or whatever. That was how many years ago now? 5 years ago? Scalding Tarn was $140 at that event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one Phoenix.
Listing them at $120.
Yeah.
All right, I guess I'll step down a little bit because I'm making my way through MTG Top 8 and I'm looking and I see everything is $1,200 or more.
Yeah, so it's not cheap.
Well, what's happened is the inverse of what, so before it was, you get your land base, your mana base, and aside from Jund being the exception, once you got the land base of Modern, you were able to go anywhere you wanted. Now, you can have the land base of it, but the staples are so expensive, and I know Raghavan is $100 a piece. Force of Negation, $100 a piece. They're just so difficult to, and those cards, Raghavan, again, one of those exception cards, are hard. They go from deck to deck, but if I wanted to go from Amulet Titan to blue red, it's a G. It's no less than that. It's so expensive.
Sure.
Where that wasn't true with other formats. Maybe there was the spike Scalding Tarn like Josh was saying, but it wasn't true about the staples of the format. Splinter Twins, $10-$15. Arclight Phoenixes, maybe $20 a piece. Those weren't expensive.
The most expensive part of Arclight Phoenix was Metamorphose back then.
Yes. Yeah. But that's the consequence of us having Modern specific released sets. And I think that's something we didn't used to have. So that's what's really influencing it. I wouldn't call it Legacy Light because they never had any Legacy influence sets.
Right. Right.
Every deck went up $400 just in Modern Horizons 1 and 2 cards.
Yes. Yeah. And that's my problem with the comparison is like Legacy just naturally over time because of EDH probably went to the moon. It went to the moon. But Modern is going to the moon because they are releasing specific cards that are very good that you need to play and you have to get them immediately or you won't be winning any tournaments.
Yes.
And so that's why I don't like the comparison to Legacy, because Legacy is still core. Like, the core cards are still the ones from 10 years ago.
15, 20 years ago, you name it.
Yeah, yeah, because you just got, like, Force of Wills are still there. Duels are still
Brainstorm.
There. LEDs are still there. Like, when we're talking expensive cards, like, Mox Diamond is still there.
Yeah.
You know, all those cards have stayed, and, like, sure, maybe you got, like, Ragavan showed up, and it was really, really good, so now everyone's playing it. But all the other core cards just don't really rotate. But in Modern, it's I wouldn't compare them at all.
Okay.
I wouldn't call it the new Legacy, because in Modern you can still I don't know how to say it, but like it's the idea is that Legacy you're never rotating.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you on that. Well, then what about Legacy the new Vintage? Meaning that a player that started 6 months ago, does he have any ability to get into Legacy today?
No.
If they are committed and have the cash, yeah. Come on in.
Yeah, but that's not the average player.
So, and here's why let me go with why Legacy is really, daunting. Vintage was always daunting to me as a Magic player, just because I always thought the cost was too high. The inability, well, Vintage is a little weird because Mox is kind of going every deck, but when you buy into a set of Moxes, you're buying into, like, a deck or shops, whatever, or Dredge, which was Bazaar of Baghdad. Those three decks don't really interact with each other, but they're all incredibly expensive in their own right. And once you kind of buy into that one, all your eggs in that basket. Like, unless you have endless cash flow where money's not an object to you, sure. But with Legacy, we're in that same argument where you buy into a Legacy deck, you're locked in. It's very difficult to then shift or try something different without spending so much of your wallet. So you're kind of pigeonholed to, this is the style of deck I will play forever.
I agree.
But do you really think that's in Modern? There's no way.
No, Modern's, you can change in Modern, but it hurts your wallet. A little bit. And that's where Legacy used to feel. And that's not what, when Underground Seas were $100, you had to switch from Underground Seas to Volcanics. Sure. You could trade them in, pay about $100 out of your pocket. Imagine now trading in Undergrounds to Volcanics. You're probably going to spend another $700 just for that exchange rate, plus whatever staples you're going to need for that deck as well, too.
Yeah, and that's what's kind of funny to me. I guess I can see your comparison a little better that way.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about how Modern, own the lands, you own the thing, not anymore. Legacy, own the lands, and you basically own it unless you want to play LEDs.
Right. Or Mox, whatever you want to call it.
Whatever weird artifact you want to play.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, you're good. You like own the lands, you're good.
Yes. And that's truly the gatekeeper of that format. And I say it's like a country club because that's really what it is. Once you've bought into the country club, you're in it for life. It's really difficult to get back in because you have to come up with a scratch for it.
The funniest part to me about that is Legacy players treat it like a country club all the time.
Oh, 100%. And
you could take me as a perfect example because I'm just like, I got my full deck already. And I'm like, I just want to make it all Japanese. Let's go.
Oh my God.
Or, you know, someone's like, I want to make it all foil. Let's go.
Yeah.
Obnox.
Yeah. it's unfortunate for any new players, but again, Wizards has made it blatantly clear that there's no support for Legacy on a national level. Mm-hmm. Only third-party people will do that. And when we run into that, it's like your options for a new player are Standard and usually Commander. And then you can get into Modern, but that's also like a daunting task for especially someone. Let me ask you this, guys. How long did it take for you to kind of commit to Magic from a spending standpoint? Because the most common thing that probably happens to players is they play, they buy something, and then they finally go to a game store, like an actual one. What are those called? Precons. They go to a game store and they see the actual prices of cards, and they go, I would never buy that. I would never spend that on a land. How long did it take for you guys to shift?
I still say that and still spend the money.
my spending is, I try not to spend money on Magic cards, but I like if I need, like I needed the Ragavan, so I bought the Ragavans, you know?
Mm-hmm. It It didn't take me too long. Like, I started, like, super early with Magic. Like, the first time I ever, like, opened a pack, I want to say was Urza's Saga, and it was because my stepbrother played, and my stepmom got him some for Christmas, and she got me some, and she was like, he plays, you should play. I didn't know what I was doing. Like, I didn't understand mana, and, like, for a long time, I didn't. And actually, the first time I ever went to an FNM was with Josh. We went to a place out in Menominee Falls, and I brought... That would have been around right when Lorwyn came out. And we went and, like, I played a fun deck that I just had cards that I picked up from, like, opening packs. And I think the first time I bought a card was, like, 2 weeks after that because, like, I started to notice, like, what competitive decks felt like and how much smoother they ran instead of playing your jumble of lands with Horde and Ocean with no dual lands.
So what was that time frame from the Lorwyn? Not the Urza Saga, like... When you actually started, I guess the better question would be when did you stop, like, buying packs and went into singles?
I mean, to be fair, I don't really even do that now, but I like being a little kid and ripping open packs. But it was probably around Eventide when I started buying singles more than packs.
Yeah,
like that and Shards Block.
What about you, Josh? Yeah.
The Shards Block. Eventide in like Lorwyn Block, I was still pretty much a child. I was still like building my janky decks and bringing them to FNM or whatever. Mm-hmm. But Shards of Alara is about when I started like, hey, I can't do this anymore. I gotta buy singles.
JB, how about you?
I think me and you were at the same time because we both started getting competitive in like 2010, right when... Like,
Zendikar.
Right before Zendikar. Yeah, right before Zendikar. And that's not to say that I wouldn't buy boxes because... I was like shark number one way back when. So I would do things like buy boxes on release day, sit around at the shop and then trade and get people for all the good stuff.
Golden age, dude. That was the golden age. You would open your box on release day. Oh my God.
I'd get so many good trades. It was insane because there was a bunch of like tabletop players who would, or kitchen table players who would come in, open their box with me because they'd see me slowly opening like two boxes throughout the day. And then I would be like, hey, check out this cool binder full of garbage I have. You want to trade me? You think any of these are cool? And then they would give me like fetch lands for a dollar card.
Yeah.
I remember doing that to you in Alara Block.
Oh, I learned real fast, let me tell you.
The first time you look up your cards or what they're worth online, and then you go, I just traded what and got a 50-cent card before? You're like, never again.
My first burn for that was I traded a Noble Hierarch for a Child of Alara. Because it was a rare for a mythic.
The exchange rate.
It was like a dollar to like 20.
I still remember trading Antonio, I think like $5 in bulk for a foil Scalding Tarn during Zendikar Block. I still remember, Tony, me and another friend had went to GU to get our box for Zendikar on release day and you got yours and you opened like, I think one fetch. And, like, your box was just, like, terrible.
Yeah.
Because I remember how defeated you looked. I felt so bad.
Dude, you spend, like, well, at the time, I was working a minimum wage job. So I saved money for that box. And then I remember I couldn't get off in time. And I asked JB, like, hey, can you buy my box? Because I want the Day of Judgment buy box promo. And you were also working a minimum wage job at the time. So you couldn't afford two boxes. And then when I got there, all the promos were out. I opened zero Day of Judgment, which was the only card I wanted to open. And I opened one fetch. And I was just like, I think that was the day I was like, I'm done buying boxes.
Yeah.
That was the day. Dude.
And we got lucky. Our box had like a playset of Day of Judgment. I think we opened like seven fetches.
I got
like
nothing
I wanted. A bunch of goblin guides. Like our box was pretty hot.
Yeah. My dog was in trash. Day of
Judgment in my pre-release pool and I traded it foil Marsh Flats after the pre-release.
With the reserve list, like we're going to swing to that. The origin of the reserve list, I'm not sure if you guys know. I'm not going to go too into detail, but if anybody is curious about it, look at what happened with Chronicles, and that's what spawned the promissory letter from Wizards of the Coast, and that's what spawned the reserve list, because that Chronicles set almost crashed the game of Magic, and what we know and love today might not exist, and to be honest, other card games might not have followed suit, and those might not exist either. So when they made this reserve list promise to the community was, we will never do something like this to ever hurt the value of your cards, because literally cards went from $20 to... stores couldn't get rid of the packs for free of Chronicles.
Was Chronicles just a reprint set?
It was 100% reprint, and it was all of the like legends of the expensive, like at the time, because Magic was so new, you know, there was random cards in there that were like legends.
The main thing that really made people mad.
It had all the same set symbols and everything, and that's what made people mad as well.
Yeah.
I also thought it was like Shivan Dragon was like really good, and there was like a vampire that everyone was really mad got printed in there because it was really good.
It might have been. Either way, you can look at the set of Chronicles today. I think Chronicle packs are still $1.99. They're not worth anything. They're still bulk because they were so massively printed and they crashed the entire market. And in that time frame, like Chronicles, the cards that were in Chronicles, they had some value in, you know, the gaming world or the meta of Magic, but that's no longer the truth. Like the only card I can think of from Chronicles is worth anything is Blood Moon.
I actually ordered today. I ordered 4 City of Brass Chronicles.
Was it because like 15 bucks?
Yeah, it was like 12 bucks because those were the only versions that I can play in my old school deck because it's either that or Arabian Nights and I'm not paying for Arabian Nights.
Well, nobody is. It's so expensive for that one. But yeah, so if you guys are interested, listen to, I'm sure there's, I'll find a YouTube link and I'll put it in our show notes of like the history of the reserve list and the explanation of why it became and what it could have done if they wouldn't have done what they did for like a future of Magic. And that's why we have what we know today is the reserve list. And I think they stopped putting cards on the reserve list after, is it Urza's Legacy? Is that the last one?
I think so.
That's where the cutoff is, because from there on out, I think they saw the issue with just constantly adding cards to it.
Destiny was the last one.
There you go. Whatever, the last block, yeah, Destiny. They stopped adding cards to it, and they saw, I think Wizards at the time saw like, hey, we can't keep throwing cards on here, just because the list will get too great, and it'll be, you know, if we ever wanted to reprint it, and they might have been thinking, because they did make core sets, well, we can't throw this into a core set. The reserve list, no. I know Mark Rosewater on his Blogatog came out with like a post saying that like some form saying that there's no chance of the reserve list going away anytime soon.
It'd be easier if we all just accepted that it's never going to happen.
Correction, he said we'd all be mentally happier.
Right.
Sure. That's a big difference.
So there's a huge, I shouldn't say a divide in the community, but there's a lot of people that want that reserve list abolished. And there I see those arguments, and I also am against it at the same time. And Josh, at one point you were all about abolishing it, and now as I just found out today that you were actually for the reserve list.
I still think it should be abolished, but I have definitely like taken that announcement as like, you know, all right, it's never going to happen. I have to accept that now, and I have to, you know, be smart about, you know, the reserve list, and I have to keep the stuff I have if I want to, you know, be able to afford this game in the future.
What is like the most common argument, the most common thing that people say that the reserve list should be gone?
Because there's no reason to be, you should have an $800 land. There's no reason for that.
The amount of players that there are in the world don't match up to the reserve list, which means not every player that exists in Magic today can actually own an Underground Sea. The numbers are just not there.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I got 2 for trade. You can own one right now.
Yeah.
He's just so, promoting himself.
What is, I guess, Jeff, what is like an obvious reason to keep that reserve list?
I don't know. No, no, I get it. Like, to an extent, like, people are afraid of getting blown out. Like, you know, you own an Underground Sea and they reprint it and the reprint's like $50. Yeah, your whiteboarded unlimited might still be around like $600, but if I'm going to want to play that card, I'm not going to go out and spend $600 on an old version when I can get a new version for $50. So, like, it does have a high chance of, like, blowing people out, but I don't know. That's a risk with any card. Like, Ragavans are $100 right now, and it could get banned and dropped to, like, 50 cents. Like, yeah, that's not as bad as losing out on an $800 card, but it's a risk. You're playing a card game. This isn't about money. It's supposed to be about playing the game.
Right. And
by having less cards out there, I feel like you asked me for fighting for the reserve list, and I just changed.
That's okay, man. I don't. I want your honest opinion on it.
I hate it because, like, I get that Legacy is like a country club, and like,
yeah,
I get that it's expensive, and I get these people have spent this money on these cards, but I don't think it's fair that, like, because you have all this money, you can play this format in this card game, but it should be accessible to everybody. Because don't you want more players? The more players you have, the more people you have to play those cards against.
But this is what irritates me about that, because I knew someone was going to talk about that. I am all for using proxies in Legacy events.
Oh, and agreed.
My problem is people who truly want it to be a country club who are like, well, I had to suffer, so do you. the people who will not allow proxies, and I think those are far and few between when you talk to most Legacy players, because they just want to play the game. Yeah. We just want to have our high tide mirror matches and feel terrible.
God, you're a terrible human being. I agree real quick, is I think I agree proxies should be allowed 100%. Like, the problem is, though, sometimes with proxies is, like, how do you do it properly? Like, you can't go into an event and play your real LEDs, but then have a piece of paper slid in a sleeve for an underground C, because, like, that's obviously going to be weighted differently. So then at that point, you have to buy a proxy, which then in tune becomes a problem, because that just, like, promotes counterfeit.
Right. So my biggest issue with that is, I understand from a local FNM level that proxies are allowed. It's a lot more casual. If someone's going to try and cheat, one, they're probably going to get figured out sooner or later. And two, what the hell are you winning? $30 store credit. Cool.
Yeah, it's a low amount.
And so at that level, I don't care about proxies. At a high level where you're talking like an NRG series 5K,
yeah,
bring real cards.
Yeah, you have to have them. That's the whole, reason.
But then again, at that point, that's just agreeing that, like, if you don't have money, you shouldn't be able to play this format.
It's a hard thing to say, but yes.
Some people are locked out of things just because they don't have it. It's right. Fine.
Which brings me to my hot take. I think that any argument for keeping the reserve list is just gatekeeping.
Oh, it is 100%. Like, that's what a country club is.
Yeah.
There's no reason other than gatekeeping. The amount of money you would lose in whatever investments you can easily make back in selling the packs of whatever the reprints of the Magic cards is. Because, granted, yeah, if they were to put dual lands in booster packs, and like, there's no MSRP anymore, so they'll charge $700 a booster pack if that comes to that or whatever. How much are revised booster packs or whatever?
Right.
Tournament packs or whatever, or starter deck. What, $1,500? Expect that pack price if they were to do it. So, like, they'd make the money back on any investments lost in selling the packs. So, you would have a hit, but the money would be able to be made back because the demand would be there.
You're talking about a single player. Yep. Exactly. Yeah,
you're talking about a store. Like, you aren't going to make money off them making those packs.
Yeah. So if a pack ends up being that high, you're right back to square one, right? You're just gatekeeping because somebody can't afford that. And not only that, you're not getting a guaranteed underground seat for $700, $800. You're getting a lottery ticket. That is
you could end up with Shivan Dragon.
Yeah. So I get where you're coming from on that perspective, because it's like, okay, well, the stores will make the money anyways. Well, that's great. You as the individual, we as the player base still suffer, you know? But this is the one argument that a lot of people don't see, and it's not obvious. And the reason I always want there to be a reserve list, and it's not because I have those cards and I am allowed, I'm grandfathered, in lack of a better term, that I can play these in these formats. It's because I like the idea of tournaments entries being low, and those costs are put on a vendor. And the reason why vendors exist is because of the reserve list. And I don't want to get too deep into it, but the reality is those vendors, they exist. I mean, if you ever think about, like, Yu-Gi-Oh, how many Yu-Gi-Oh stores that are dedicated to Yu-Gi-Oh are there compared to Magic stores? It's not even close. And if you ever look at the cost of what a Yu-Gi-Oh card is worth versus what a Magic card is worth, the ratio, you usually about on average get like 50 to 75% of your Magic card. Yu-Gi-Oh, if a card's $100, you can sell that card for about $8 to $12 to a vendor. And that is atrocious. And that's why there's so few vendors, because the difficulty of getting those cards and selling them online is much higher, just because.
That's also because Yu-Gi-Oh doesn't have a reserve list. And when cards tend to get too expensive, they reprint it right away. No vendor is going to want to spend $60 on an $80 card when they know in a couple months Konami's just going to reprint it.
Or Secret Lair.
Right.
You know, then you take the store out of the equation, and now we have a real problem.
Secret Lair still doesn't help price, though, I don't think.
I'll admit, at the beginning of the year with all the Secret Lairs, I was convinced that we were going to get Secret Lair dual lands this year.
I mean, if we look at a convention center, I don't know if you've ever... I've worked for vendors before. The cost at a table there is anywhere from... it used to be up for bid, but now the starting bid from the last one I've ever attended or worked at was like $8,000 just for the table. And that's not even including hotel internet. If you want the internet there, tack another $800 right there. So your cost and travel and all that is already at, you're already at a $10,000 deficit right there. And the reason why that exists is because they have 10, 12, 15, 20 vendors. They pay for the room. That cost is not given to you, the player. Now, if you want to participate in the event, that's a separate subsector of it. But to actually just go there and walk around and attend the event, it's free. Whereas I think what would end up happening is if you were to abolish the reserve list, vendors don't pay that. Now to get into the event, it's $200, which is another form of gatekeeping to just go in there and look at the things.
Right.
You know what I mean? And there might not be anything to look at. And it actually might turn down tournament attendance greatly. I mean, we had a Commander Fest. And that, the vendors that I know that went to the Command Fest, it was the cheapest thing. They made the most money there because they didn't have to pay it. But that cost, that burden was put onto the player. So that's my argument for keeping that reserve list, because it is valuable to vendors to exist. And the reserve list going away could mean the demise of organized play. And it's an extreme, but let's face it. I mean, I'm pretty happy with a GP costing $60 to $100 for tournament entry, whereas if that goes away, the tournament entry might be a $200 badge on top of the $100 entry, which I think would deter people away.
Are like having GPs free is like being able to just go to a GP, not playing in the main event, just bum around, look at the things and trade, or, you know, just play casually all day is like something that is critical to having in this community.
Yeah, I love it.
It's great.
It's why it's called The Gathering.
I can't remember the last time I did that, but I do agree that it is valuable.
You know what else you'll lose if you get rid of the reserve list?
Go on.
You playing Tabernacle?
Yes. Well, no, I can still play it. But
it won't be as devastating because you won't be like the only person in like a 50-mile radius to have one.
Sure. Yeah, you're right. So think about it like this. When you go to those big tournaments and you go and look at those cases, if you're just looking at like $50 cards, $100 cards, you're like, whatever. But then you see those reserve list cards, and that's like something to shoot for if you're like into trading or like you want to like build towards something. Like there's a goal there. And I think I like that too. I like going and looking at cases and seeing all the crazy stuff in them.
I don't know. I look at $50 to $100 cards and I'm like, I really don't want to spend this on this card.
Right. That's why you got to trade.
Yeah, you can trade.
I want all cards to be like $4.
That'd be great to an extent. It would just, I think, kill off the game because a lot of collectors get out and then. I don't know.
I'm not saying that's what it should be. Like, and honestly, $50 to $100 isn't that bad for a Magic card. Like, I've spent more on one single card before in my life, but...
Well, it was in the beginning, like, when you first started, you couldn't fathom that, and then you just slowly get tricked, you keep playing these tricks on yourself, you know what, $20, oh, $40 is okay, oh, $100 is okay, and then now you have that standard of, I don't care what the card costs, I want it.
All I was going to say is what's the most expensive card you spent, or most you've spent on one single card? I think the most I've ever done was Volcanic, and I spent $275.
Mm.
I bought a $500 Volcanic.
Most on one card. I can tell you that my biggest TCG player orders, because I've had those almost at a G.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just meant one card.
No, I have a volume of cards where spending is no longer a thing to me. I trade cards for cards. So when I want something, I go and I rarely have to break out of my pocket. Ragavans are the exception because I saw them at $50. I immediately went and swooped them up at $50 apiece, and then I was pretty happy with it. They'll never leave my play collection, even probably when they get banned, just like how Oko's haven't left my play collection, and same with the other things.
I depends. Are you talking cash plus card or just cash?
The most that you spent like via cash. Well, do both. Just do both.
So the biggest I've probably had was my trade from an Italian Tabernacle up to an English one that was like an 8.5.
Mm-hmm.
And that was $600 cash for Liliana of the Veils. The crummy Italian beat up one that I had, and like another like $500 in cards in trade value. Jesus.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was like two Mox Diamonds, a $600 cash, two duels, and some other junk for that Beta Taiga that I got.
I was gonna say that Beta Taiga turned into like what, like six dual lands?
Yeah. So I wanted to bring this is related to kind of what I was talking about a year ago, again, in terms of what I thought prices were going to be doing and why something you could think about for the reserve list in terms of collectability still is that without the reserve list, the rarity of things like alpha and beta duels alpha, beta, and even unlimited to a degree, because it's the only, it'd be like the white bordered version you could get of these cards that has low printings. There's only like 2,000 beta Taigas out there, right?
Right.
And the price of those is still going to be really, really strong, even if they reprint a card, because there are so few. Same thing with like the original Tabernacle, because they're not going to do it in the same art. And even if they did, you could be like, well, here is the original Tabernacle. There's only 2,500 of these that exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of those super rare, hard to get cards would still be expensive, which is one of the reasons why I traded into that Taiga, beta Taiga, is because I thought, I'm going to future-proof myself, because if they do decide to reprint, this beta Taiga is still going to be worth a bajillion dollars.
Yeah, it's like this. It's like the first edition Charizard.
Right. They or even you can look at Magic. They hand out Shivan Dragon for free now, but an Alpha Shivan Dragon is still $500.
Yeah.
But that's like, kind of, I agree with that, but so from the other point of view, though, you could sell that, like, I don't know, Tabernacle you have now, and someone's going to buy it. It's not going to take long for someone to want to buy it because there's only those printings. But if you reprint it, that opportunity to sell it for that cost is going to be a lot harder. You're going to be stuck with that. Like a beta Taiga, let's say, is worth $5,000 and they reprint it. You selling it for $5,000 is going to be a lot harder when there's a black border one for $50 that just got reprinted. Now that $50 one didn't exist, you're able to sell that beta still.
People like pimp stuff.
Mm-hmm. To an extent, but like, think about it, the new ones would be foil also.
And you say it's like easy for me to go and sell this. I'm gonna tell you right now, it is. It is.
I'm not saying it's easy, but like the likelihood of you selling it is gonna be even less.
Yeah. Sure. There's a reason I kinda wanna go to GP Vegas, is because I wanna see what kind of offers I would get on it.
On what?
On the Tabernacle. And you know, like a big tournament is the only place I'm going to get that from a dealer.
Well, I've seen people do that when we were vending. We had guys that had like, hey, I got this, you know, piece of power. Here's an unlimited Mox Jet. You know, I'm going to walk. What's your number on this? You look at it. Okay, 1800. And then they go basically to every single one of them. And then they go to the highest bidder. And yeah, we've won those two.
Alpha Time Twister, I did that.
Uh-huh.
Oh, by the way, if you guys want to laugh at me a bunch, I looked at the price of beta Taigas. Oh, I got ripped off.
Why? What are they up to now?
They've all spiked.
They went from like 2,200 up to like $3,000 or more.
Yeah. I mean,
this is why I tell you never get rid of the Tabernacle. It only goes up. Stonks.
I agree with the Tabernacle, but the Taiga I don't think is that bad, because you turned it into like six other dual lands that you're going to be able to want to play, and you have a white border Taiga, so it's not like it matters that you have this specific black border. You traded it for other reserveless cards, so those lands are going to go up too. So you didn't really lose, because I'm sure, add up the lands you have now, I'm sure they're more than what they were when you traded for them.
And like, it's not like I did like with the trade up to that English one or whatever, I went from, you know, $800 Italian to $2,100 or $1,800 English or whatever for way too much. Yeah. And now it's at like $4,000.
It's only going to go up, my dude.
Usually, so, you know, there's wins and losses.
That's just the trade game anyways. Like, things come and go, but the reality of the trade game is it's a game of volume. How much are you moving? And trading moving, yeah, keeps going up. Just accumulate more cards and it'll be better.
Trading reserve list stuff is scary. There's just too much.
Well, most people that are like doing those trades are, one, verifiable, and if you're trying to sell me something like via reserve list and you don't have a Facebook, you don't have like a way for me to find you, I don't want your thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you have to be a reputable source, and meaning that, like, this is one of the things that the vintage community has. They all know each other. They all know who's playing, because they get together once a year for their vintage tournament, and they see the same faces year after year. When you're a newcomer, usually it goes like red alert, like, this guy's got fakes, this guy's got fakes, watch him, you know, and that's like truly talked about. That does happen.
Because there's only like 20 vintage players that exist.
100, but they're all in the same group together.
Yeah, and they all know one another because they get together every year.
Yeah. They do, and then it's just one of those things. They all know who each other are, so when there is a newcomer, like, usually someone at the tournament can verify, oh, I sold one of my extra pieces of power to that guy, and then it's kind of like, that's legitimately what it is. I kid you not.
With the power, there is a power community.
Yes, and they are strong, meaning they are the ultimate country club.
They are.
All right, Tony, we got to get in that country club. Let's go.
Come on in there, dude. I hate golf.
in my rolled a recall, a Black Lotus, and a Alpha Time Twister, and like there's a lot, there's a circle, and they all check up on each other, like Tony says. They all.
I'm not even kidding you. They know who's. They know when things are moving, and they should, because they want to protect their own investment. And the best way to do that is to one, stop a surplus of fakes all of a sudden just flooding their market, and then
the art community.
Yeah, well, art is just a way to evade taxes.
All right, let's get back on topic.
No, that's it, man. I got nothing else.
We're down to the worst part of the podcast.
I already did that. I countered all your arguments. I am right. Therefore, reserve list stays.
Oh,
take that
God.
One to the
what
bank.
If he agreed with you. Did you counter that?
Now what? I think it's worth it to get even like the bad like reserve list cards, like the Thunder Dragon or whatever.
No.
I love those. I have so many bad reserve list cards.
That.
I find a lot of bad reserve list cards in bulk. I get so happy. Yeah.
Nice question of the week.
I don't got one.
Wow. Way to go.
Right. I thought this podcast went long enough. So take us out. Josh, you already had your hot take. What was it again?
Eldraine Adventures are the best MDFCs. It is Wednesday, my dude.
What just happened?
See ya.
It was just him, like, railing on him.
I can't hear anything.
I don't know.
Interesting. Why can't I hear?
Go to your Discord. Well, he can't hear me, so what the hell?
Just keep telling him vocally what to do.
Do it!
Hey, do idiot, how about you just...
Hey, moron, fix your
Josh, can you hear this? You're stupid. You're dumb. You've never been good at Magic, and don't ever forget.
Oh, got him. Sell your computer.
Yeah.
Oh, your computer.
The best was the one week you weren't there, Tony. Even like, you guys got to stop letting Tony like say
push us around.
Yeah, and say he's right. You need to
good
disagree
luck.
With him. When,
well, yeah, because
you
he never stops.
Well, me,
it's
I
a never-ending torrent.
I will never. Tony's terrible time to talk torrent.